Good evening, everyone, and thank you so much for returning back after our glitch event last week. Thank you for returning. It's great to be back. Just a quick recap, because it has been a couple of weeks. I want to kind of build up the topic to where we've arrived, to kind of build up some momentum, and then we'll take it forward to part three this evening. So Rav Dessler began this series, he began this Kuntras HaBechira, this essay on Bechira, by talking about addiction, something we referenced that Rav Dessler himself had struggled with nicotine addiction during his lifetime. And he talked about this idea that a person is not really struggling with two different desires. Really, it's a person, Bechira breaks down, a person chooses what they don't really want. A person is really guided by rationalization. The person rationalizes, there's more copies over there. A person rationalizes that the wrong thing could be right, that just one more cigarette, it's not going to kill me, it's okay to do this. A person can rationalize and fool themselves into doing all kinds of things. And the idea of Bechira is for a person to stop fooling him or herself. It's for a person to recognize what's MS, what's Sheker. Because a person, by rationalizing, proves that they know what the right thing is to do. Otherwise, they wouldn't have to rationalize to make sense of it. So a person's real job, when it comes to Bechira, a person's real job is to be able to recognize what is MS, what is Sheker, and that's what Bechira. Rav Dessler introduced the idea of the Bechira point, that there are certain things that are not really in a person's current 50-50 control to challenge what's MS, what's Sheker. Because they're what's below a person's Bechira point, they're already so easy for a person. A person's already either from a young age or has been doing it for so long that they find it easy to do a certain mitzvah or abstain from a certain avera. Certain things can be beyond a person's bechira point. They're not up to that level yet. They never were trained for that, or they're so far from that level of mitzvos or from abstaining from an avera that that's beyond their bechira point. And the real challenge is within a person's bechira point, what's currently between the two armies, what the person has to struggle with. And part number two, last time we met, we talked about, so how does that lead us to schar ve'onesh? We talked about this idea that a person has a bechira point that's decided min hashamayim. A person has some starting point based on parents and generation. Those are like a fixed starting bechira point. And then a person's actions throughout his or her life will push the bechira point in one direction or another. And then even if a person takes an action out of their bechira point, for good or for bad, really that schar for that action is a butterfly effect of what they did earlier to push themselves in that direction. And we concluded last time by talking about a person's starting bechira point maybe really is a credit to their parents more than a person, him or herself, that we talked about Lot, that Lot's real schar was not for the things that came easy, that were come by his upbringing, about Avram Avinu and Bimach Nesorchim. Lot's real challenge when it came to greed, when it came to not revealing that Avram and Sarah were actually husband and wife, that was a real challenge for him. A person gets rewarded at the bechira point. Okay, and the question we left off with last time, and where we're going to pick up right now, is, so then why is it fair that certain people start in one place and others start somewhere else? Why should some start with a background of morality and wealth and success, and others, their bechira point seems to start from a different vantage point altogether, where they have a bad upbringing, or they weren't given really a choice or a chance to learn so much? So that's one question I want to start off with tonight. You know, I'm thinking of a story I read somewhere about a little girl who learned that one of her classmates was adopted. And this girl gets it into her head. She's like, well, you know, maybe I'm adopted too. She goes home and she asks, like, Mom, am I adopted? Her mom says, no, you're not adopted. But the little girl's not convinced. She comes back the next day and she says, you know, Mom, I'm really curious. Am I adopted? The mom says, no, you're not adopted. But again, day after day, she keeps asking, am I adopted? Am I adopted? And finally, the mom is so frustrated and she says, no, you're not adopted yet, but we'll keep looking. We'll see if you can find you someone to take care of you, right? So to some extent, we don't really choose our parents. Sometimes parents can choose kids, but really, we don't really choose who our parents are. And this is the question we left off last time, to try to understand, why is it fair? So we're not going to really be able to answer the question of why it's fair, why certain people were given a silver spoon, and why certain people were given more poverty, and certain people were given a good education, and certain people were given not a good education, morality, not morality, schools, either Jewish chinuch or not Jewish chinuch, moral role models or not moral role models. But I did one time read a beautiful analogy from a Ben Zion Schaefer, who has books and podcasts called The Shmooze. He has such a beautiful analogy that doesn't answer the question, but it does give a framework to the question. You know, Rav Dessler gave us this idea that a person is not judged based on the objective, what they do, what they don't do. It's about what's within a person's bechira point, which a lot of it is predetermined, and how do they grow from their starting point. Rabbi Schaefer described a similar idea, and he said, this is the way that actors are judged. When actors are judged in their performance by the academy, they're not judged based on the character and the wealth of the character and the intelligence of the character and the virtuousness of the character. They're judged by how well they play the character. The character may be precast, predecided, and that's the role that they have to play, but their only question now is, how well are you going to play the role that you've been given? The example I like to think of, going back to my childhood, is The Dark Knight, which is a Batman movie. People know this movie, The Dark Knight? Right? So Heath Ledger, who played the Joker in that movie, one of the most infamous villains of all time in comic book lore, right? So Heath Ledger won an Academy Award for his performance as the Joker. And he won it posthumously. He had passed away before receiving the award. And Heath Ledger was treated as a legend because he played the Joker more convincingly and to a different degree than maybe others had before him. I read somewhere that Heath Ledger locked himself in a hotel room for months and months and months with different makeup ideas and really tried to get himself into the character. Now you could say, he won an Academy Award? The guy's a psychopath. He kills people and he blows things up and he does all these terrible things. Why should he get rewarded? The answer is, he's an actor playing a character. The question is, how well does he play the character that he's been given? Someone else will play a character who's very simple and very unsophisticated and very, very kind and very sweet and very rich and very healthy and all these things, but they play it miserably. They're not convincing in that role. They don't maximize that role, and they're not winning any awards. Which person is better? But he's richer, he's smarter, and it's not fair, and the Joker is crazy. The reality is, all the actor has to do is play the role convincingly. If they play the role convincingly, then that's how they're praised, that's how they're rewarded. Rabbi Schaefer explained each of us is given a job to do, and a lot of it's predetermined. Our IQ, our temperament, our families, generation, our chinuch that we received, the friends we were put around when we were very little, much of what our role is in life is predetermined. There are some choices we make down the line, how we choose to play the character, how we choose to maximize the character. But at the end of the day, this is very much a Rav Dessler idea, schar va'onesh, the ultimate praise and reward for how well we play the character, has nothing to do with the content of the character. A person who plays a difficult situation very well is going to be rewarded for having done a great job within that role, within those circumstances, where someone who had it easy but played the character miserably is a nothing. He didn't maximize the challenge. He didn't maximize the character given to him or her. What an interesting idea. It doesn't explain how Hashem chooses which person gets which role. So it requires a degree of emuna that the director, with a capital D, the director, the writer, the script designer, he knows what's best for each person, who's typecast and who's best fit to play a certain role, who's going to play the wealthy philanthropist, who's going to pay the beggar and then the person who's needy, who's going to pay the person who has terrible anger problems. You know, these ideas are not the stage may be preset, but how well you choose to play the character is different. You know, Chazal point out that David HaMelech had a similar temperament to Esav, speaking of this week's parsha of Esav. David HaMelech had a very similar temperament. Shmuel Navi was hesitant to want to anoint David HaMelech. The reality is that maybe David HaMelech did have similar qualities to Esav. But Esav took it one direction. He played the character this way. And David HaMelech played the character a different way. He became a king. He became a warrior. He became a person who fought for everything and made it his life's effort to build the Beis HaMikdash, put his passion into Tehillim, into music. The temperament may be there. And that may be fixed with when a person's born, who their parents are. But a person is still given free will. A person is still given the choice of how you're going to play the character. Given where your starting point is, how well, how convincingly, how inspiringly are you going to play that character? And Rav Dessler, I gave it to you at the end of today's sources. We're not really going to read it inside. If you have booklets, and I'll share the screen in a minute. But in volume 4, which we're not reading, but in volume 4, he has a lot about this idea to talk about. That even within two people who are poor, for some people, poverty may be a life circumstance. They're going to be poor their entire lives. No matter how much they daven, they're always going to be poor because their job in life is to be the best poor person that they could be. Empathy and compassion and fighting for justice for people who are also poor. And for someone else, poverty is an obstacle to overcome and see if they can go from rags to riches. Because when it comes to a character, sometimes people are typecast as a rich person, some are typecast as a poor person. Even within poor people, sometimes the script is for a person to overcome that challenge. Other times it's to be the best poor person and accomplish the most with those limitations that a person can accomplish. So the exact setup for each person may be predetermined, but it doesn't take away the idea of free will. Rudastra's Bechira point says that as long as a person looks at the challenge in front and says, how can I maximize this moment right now? How can I play the best character version of this character I've been given, the director with a capital D typecast me to be, that's going to determine their ultimate praise, their ultimate accolades and reward, because that's going to show that they took the role they were given and maximized it. What do you think of this idea? Is it resonating?
Medrash.
One second. I'll come back in a second. Yeah, go ahead, Bert. Go ahead.
There was a medrash that said they looked at Moshe Rabbeinu's face and they said, this is a face of a murderer.
Mm-hmm.
And that was possible, that that was in his character. But he didn't become a murderer. He became a gadol in Israel. He conquered his nature. That's what we all have to do.
I'll repeat it for the Zoomers, that Moshe Rabbeinu, Chazal, I think the Taras Yisrael quotes this type of medrash, that Moshe Rabbeinu somehow was predetermined to be some sort of either bloodthirsty or a murderous person, and Moshe Rabbeinu channeled it into rescuing people who were being attacked and becoming a great leader to provide for many. Yeah, Ilan, you wanted to add something else.
Thank you. I was just thinking, though, on one hand, it's certainly an interesting idea insofar as what we're doing is essentially is channeling or dealing with the cards that were, you know, dealt with, and that's certainly creative and something we should strive to do. But on the other hand, we have various Mamre Chazal with certain of our enemies, like, for example, Nebuchadnezzar, that were not for the fact that he took it too far in playing the role, to use your analogy, he would have been praised, because Hashem ultimately sent him as an agent of destruction, and he did his job in that regard. It's only that he decided to overplay the role, to use the Joker analogy or the character analogy. And as a result, he basically overdid it in terms of what he did, so that obviously would sort of stop him from doing it. But based upon, you know, this idea, the premise of it, it appears that if you're dealt cards in a certain manner by Hashem to, as I'm not talking about this as a Jew now, but as just as a human being, to conduct evil acts and to be a mass murderer, and as long as you do it according to the way that Hashem ultimately contemplated, according to his will, then actually you could paradoxically be a tzaddik, even though you are a mass murderer.
Interesting, right? This really comes up, the Rambam and the Ramban discuss, right? That the Rambam and the Ramban discuss this in Parshas Lech Lecha in the context of Bris Ben Avsarim, right? Why were the Egyptians punished for carrying out Bris Ben Avsarim if HaKadosh Baruch Hu pre-told and predetermined that they were going to be Jewish people tortured and babies thrown into the river, maybe, right? Why were they punished for that? So the Rambam says that no one asked you to be the volunteers. Even though the prophecy was foretold, no one asked you to be them. The Ravid there on the Rambam and the Ramban, they disagree. They say, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu prophesies it, if it's an actual prophecy, there's nothing wrong, argued the Ramban and the Ravid on the Rambam, there's nothing wrong with stepping up to fulfill the prophecy. According to the Ramban, according to the Ravid, they went too far. Throwing babies in the ocean, that part was never foretold. That was actually taking it a step further. So Ilan, to your point, I'm not sure if we would say that any time a person does something evil and the right degree of evil, that they're off the hook for volunteering. The Rambam would definitely disagree with that. And the Ramban and the Ravid would say that maybe you're taking it too far. Either way, the Ramban and the Ravid are limited to a case of prophecy. When there was a foretold prophecy, and the people knew about the prophecy, and they said, I'm going to volunteer to be the one, the Rambam still thinks you're culpable for volunteering to do evil. The Ramban and the Ravid could say, if you follow the exact proscribed amount, you're off the hook, but only because it's a prophecy. For a person to do evil things and say, well, it must have been part of God's plan, so I'm off the hook, it's a little bit of an extra step.
Yeah, the only danger with that is that you could take things like the Tochacha and Kitavo and extrapolate it, which I've seen people do to things like the Holocaust.
Oh, gosh.
Where they have various psukim and they say out that in itself that is a prophecy of the Holocaust. And as a result, you end up with rather absurd conclusions, such as the Nazis, Yimach Shemam Zichram, as long as they were doing what ultimately Hashem wanted to a certain extent, because then the Holocaust occurred, you know, and Hashem didn't stop it. So to some degree, Hashem, Kivyachol, I mean, this is, again, crazy to even say this, but wanted, and I'm putting that in quotation marks, for it to occur. Then based upon that, again, you come to the conclusion, according to the Ramban and the Ravad, as you were saying, you know, fall back on them, I think very wisely at this point, because it's a crazy to say that the Nazis in Yimach Shemam Zichram were, to a certain extent, doing Hashem's will.
Yeah, that is a little crazy. You know, you could argue it was too far. You could argue it wasn't prophesied. Now, Michael, you have something you wanted to say?
I was going
to
say, because we're all in lines with Mr. Pechman was saying, that the famous Gemara, which still talks about, if someone's got a temper, they're supposed to use it to be a butcher, or murderous tendencies, whatever tendencies we have to be used only for good and take it and channel it in a way you can. Much along the lines of what Mr. Nelson said.
Yeah, so I'll just repeat it for those on Zoom. The Gemara in Shabbos and Daf Kuf Nun Vav at the end says that those born under Mars are going to be murderous people. So Mars says, yeah, but it doesn't mean a person is locked into one result. A person could be a shochet, a person could be a mohel, a person could be a doctor, right? So there's different options for a person. So the temperament may have been predetermined, but a person can choose how to channel it. You're going to say something similar?
Oh, that Gemara also is implied by the Chasam Sofer. The Chasam Sofer's son-in-law on this week's parsha talking about why Yitzchak was or was not fooled by Esav, and that he saw what Esav had the potential to be.
Mm-hmm.
That Esav had certain predispositions, but if he would have used them for the good, tracking with the Gemara that talks about how a person could be a shochet or a moel, or go l'ra, and he saw Esav, wasn't fooled by him, but invested his energies in him because he saw that if he used it for the good, he would be that much greater than Yaakov could be.
Excellent. I'll repeat it for those on Zoom in case they didn't hear it, that the question is always asked, how could Yitzchak be so fooled to think that Esav was deserving of the brachos? And what approach? Rav Dessler himself actually takes this. We're not reading this now, but Rav Dessler himself in a different volume has this exact approach, that Yitzchak was never going to give the special brachos of Brisman Absarim about the destiny, about spreading monotheism in the world. If you look at the brachos that Yaakov, quote-unquote, took, it's about giving him physical resources. The brachos that Yitzchak was going to give to Yaakov was always going to be Berchas Avram at the end of the parsha. Yitzchak calls Yaakov back and gives him Berchas Avram, as a psukim described. That was always Yitzchak's plan. The goal was to give Esav and to channel his aggression, to channel his leadership qualities. The plan was to have some kind of balance of Yaakov and Esav, where Yaakov was the Talmud Chacham and spread monotheism, and Esav was a capture of David HaMelech, right? To be a person who's able to be political and a monarch and be able to dominate and conquer, right? So it's a very, very nice partial connection that there's some way to channel even the most angry or more difficult temperaments, that these starting points don't necessarily take away Bechira or be unfair. It's just that this is where a person's starting point is and they can make the best choices that they have going forward. So let's dive into the rest. We'll finish Kuntras of Bechira right now. Very, very, you know, so many facets to this discussion of Bechira, divine providence versus Bechira, how do our individual choices further the national destiny of the world? Very, very interesting questions we've touched upon. And our guest is now going to round out the discussion with a recap of what he mentioned before, and we'll make a couple of new points to kind of round off the series. So Perakeh, so we're on the bottom of page one in your booklets, and on the screen you can see it as well. Right, on the screen we can still see it? So Rav Dessler talks about what's really a free person. Madrigas ben Chorin, who really has the status of a free person? Rav Dessler says, Hinei achokrim mechanim lebechira b'shem bechira chavshis. Typically, scientists or people, philosophers, when they talk about this issue, they usually term bechira as bechira chavshis, free will. You have it? The bottom of the page?
Yes.
Right? Scientists typically call it... Yeah. They usually call it free will. Aval kishe nis'amik b'davar, when we delve into it deeply, and we already have, Hashem hazeh, that phrase, free will, free choice, 50-50 decisions, matim rak al shetach mugbal. It's a very limited scope for what's actually within a person's bechira point that we can say they have 50-50 choice. V'haynu asher b'nekudas ha-bechira, that what's in that wheelhouse. The point of the army is fighting. Ha'adam chafshi haneo, a person is free in that sense. Levchor bi'atzmo mibli asher yachrichenu le'ezet tzad. As we already explained, a person is not forced. For the issues that are currently in a person's bechira point, they have free will. Amnam l'malam minekodas bechira so asher sham ha'adam bereshus yitzro hara. The things that a person hasn't conquered yet, they're way beyond their bechira point. Hineo mochrach, he's forced in a sense. He's forced that he hasn't been able to overcome this Avera, which is so lofty, or to daven every word with Kavanah, which is so beyond a person at this current point. He's forced by the Yetzirah, which in the areas he hasn't conquered yet. And so too on the good side. Also for the areas that are beneath a person's Bechira point. There are areas a person doesn't struggle at all. A person's been davening for 50 years. Putting on tefillin for 50 years, making brachos for 50 years, not murdering for 15 years, for 50 years. For a person to say that I've overcome Bechira every time I don't murder or every time I put on tefillin, you could argue for a person that it's beneath the Bechira point, those are not the areas of free choice either. Gam sham hu mukhrach la'asos ha'tov. In those areas, he's quote-unquote forced to do the right thing. Ki kvar kibo alav o malchus shemayim. He's already accepted this is the right thing to do. Asher yachrichenu la'asos ha'tov ahu bein motza. He doesn't have really a choice in that regard. He knows he's been going to daven. He's not going to choose to eat a ham sandwich today or murder someone tomorrow. V'zeu asher yizakel ha'adam elav ba'achso b'yira shemayim. And that's the great value. A person can move more things under the Bechira point and make them easy. Ukeshehu, where it's underlined. Ukeshehu b'madrega zo, misbarlo shelo hayachavshi me'olam. As a person conquers more things and makes them easy, makes them automatics, they're not really free. And a person can move the Bechira point so far that they're so good and they do so many good things without really having to struggle with it, that it's hard to call that free will. Are they really free? And at the times when they weren't doing it, were they really free not to? Going back to that first year where Dessler said, real Bechira means for a person to stop fooling themselves, to stop thinking that I can smoke one more cigarette and it's not going to kill me. When a person finally has clarity and they're finally able to stop, is that really free will? He doesn't like the word free. Free implies totally unrestricted, totally a blank slate, tabula rasa, there's no holds bar. He doesn't like that phrase because the problem is a person is currently being bogged down by this rationalization and this self-deception that just one more cigarette's not going to kill me. Once it boils down to, if I keep smoking, I'm going to die eventually, what kind of free choice is that? Is it really a free choice for a person to say, should I walk around today or stick my head in the fire? Each of us technically has a choice to stick our face in the fire. Would you argue every time a person doesn't stick their face in the fire, they're exercising free choice? Free will? When something is so clear as right and wrong, and it's so clear how detrimental a certain action would be, he's arguing it's hard to call that free will. I had a 50-50 choice of sticking my face in the fire, and last second I caught myself and I overcame the Yitzhar and I said, no, don't stick your face in the fire. Who would do that? Sticking your face in the fire is so obviously sheker, so obviously damaging and harmful, that for a person to make that choice, quote unquote, isn't really a choice. It's a forced choice. Skip down to the next paragraph. V'zoi ikar avodas ha'adam. That's really what our avoda in life is. Let's say it's min ha'chafshiyus. He doesn't like the term free will. He likes bechira point. There are current things right now I can choose where I'm struggling with them. And as I continue to move, they become easy. They become automatics. They become the same thing as sticking your face in the fire. At some point we say, when I eat a cheeseburger, would I eat poison? It's the same thing to me. I would never eat poison. It's obviously bad for me. It's obviously going to kill me. So why would I eat a ham sandwich? Be Michal Shabbos? I'm so beyond that. A person may have grown up in a scenario where keeping Shabbos was not so obvious, and texting was really hard for the person. Doing business and closing their shop was really hard for them. It was really a challenge. Maybe at some point it was even beyond what they were capable of closing their store and risking their family starving. Maybe it was beyond the Mechira point. And then over time they got better, and then it was a challenge. How early to close their store for Shabbos, taking off half of Shabbos, and at a certain point it's, I'm keeping Shabbos, and it's easy. At no point is it really free. It's not really free. Once you conquer it and it becomes obvious to you, then it's obvious not to do it. And in a moment where it's not obvious to you and your family is starving and you don't see the value of Shabbos, then it's obvious you're supposed to work and save your family. Whatever a person rationalizes themselves to believe it makes sense to them, they're going to do. This idea of a free choice, at any given moment a person has no restrictions and everything is an equal choice, he doesn't like that term. Because the goal really is for a person to recognize that we want to make things obvious to ourselves. If we really stop rationalizing and we stop fooling ourselves, when it comes to mitzvahs, they're going to become obvious. Where he says, for a person to exit min ha-matzav asher ha-emes va-sheker shavim lefanav, on the second line of the second paragraph, for a person over time, the goal of life is to exit a situation where good and evil, truth and falsehood are two equal options in front of the person. El hachreach, a person should get to a point where it's obvious and it's forced. Shiyaker b'levavo, hishtabdu so ilav yisparach, where it's obvious and the only right thing a person could think about is not sticking their hand in the fire, taking the paycheck, doing the good thing that seems obvious, avoiding the bad thing which seems pernicious, and then a person actually benefits by doing mitzvahs. V'chiyuv alisa ha'ol hazeh. Ki amru chazal, ha-mitzvos ain't an elegzeros. I think this is a very important point, that Chazal referred to mitzvos not as a free choice. But they call them gzeros. They're gzeros of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Just the way it is, the same way nature, we can't argue with nature. We don't have a choice to put our hand in the fire and say, maybe it's not going to burn me this time. We know what's going to happen. So what if mitzvos were exactly the same way? What if mitzvos were a forced choice? What if the goal of the person is to accomplish so much, to learn so much, and to do so much, and to be inspire themselves so much, and to work on themselves, and to keep at it, to a point where it doesn't feel like a free choice anymore? They work so hard to get the emes and to dispel the sheker, that they come to a point where, for me to do mitzvos, is not a matter of 50-50 choice. It's obvious. I think Ilan asked this at the end of the last year. Can a person get to a point where everything is kind of under the Bechira point and everything is easy? And if that's the case, have they lost their avoda? Or that's what we're saying, no, that's the goal. Can a person keep progressing to a point where everything is obvious? As obvious as tefillin, as obvious as kashrus, so too about insulting someone. Can it get to a point where a person says, to call someone a name to embarrass someone? That's like sticking my head in the fire. I would never do that. It's not a choice. You want to be in a case where you to embarrass someone and to insult someone and to quote-unquote murder someone emotionally, where it's a 50-50 choice? Or can we work on ourselves to the point where I would never speak Lashon Hara? I would never daven Me'al Kavana? I'm talking to the king and I'm not thinking about what I'm saying? I'm talking to the king who can read my thoughts and I'm thinking about the sports game? Never! I can't possibly do that. Now, it's a challenge. Life has a long way to go. Rosh Hashem, we have a lot of work to do and a lot of growth. Mentioned last time, there's a lot of Taryag mitzvos, Taryag categories of mitzvos, because many areas, each of us can look at one area and say, there's more for us to grow. We're not finished yet. There's always something for us to do. But this is the avoda. The avoda is to get to a point where it's not a choice. Not living life where every decision is a 50-50 choice. We want to live life where we've worked on the clarity of Shabbos and Kashrus and Brachos and interpersonal relationships and but being there for family. Whatever it is that we're doing, everything should be so clear to us that I don't have to think about it. Should I be mean to my spouse? Should I beat up my kids? What? No! That's like eating poison. That's like sticking your hand in the fire. Every single issue we want to work on should get to a point where it's no longer a free choice. Or it's a forced choice. It's a gzera. It's obvious. Dessler is talking about this idea that mitzvos should not feel to a person like a choice. I don't have a choice. Mitzvos are gzeros. I don't have a choice to keep Shabbos. I have to keep Shabbos. If I see Shabbos as like part of nature, it's a gzera, it's like gravity, I don't have a choice if I want to follow the laws of gravity or not. I follow the laws of gravity because I live in this world and I follow the world. The chukim, mishpatim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's laws and the mitzvos are something that define the world. They define reality. And I live by them because I have to live by them. He is describing this to show how a person could improve their avodas Hashem. What I think is interesting is that sometimes this exact approach could be explaining why it's hard. Sometimes bechira comes back. A person struggles with something specifically because they feel forced. You know, Chazal have an expression. If I asked you, what do you think? Who should get more schar for a mitzvah? A person who's obligated to do the mitzvah or a person who's not obligated but volunteers to do the mitzvah? A man is obligated to shake a lulav. A woman is not obligated to shake a lulav, but she can volunteer to shake a lulav. Who gets more schar for shaking a lulav? A man who has to do it or a woman who volunteers? Now, I would have said the person volunteering gets more schar. The person who's obligated in this particular mitzvah has to do the mitzvah. But someone who volunteers, wow, what a great person. You're stepping up, doing more than you have to do. That's phenomenal. What do Chazal say? The opposite. Chazal say, Gadol ha-matzuva ve'osa, a person who is obligated, commanded, and does the mitzvah, is greater, gets more schar than a person who is ain't a matzuva ve'osa, a person who is volunteering to do it. And why would that be? Why would a person get more schar when they have to, as opposed to when it's voluntary? Shouldn't a person who's volunteering get more reward for stepping up and doing things they didn't have to do? So look at Tosfos, Maseches Kedushin, Maseches Avodah Zarah. Tosfos have a very, very nice psychological approach, where Tosfos say, when a person has to do something, the Yetzer Hara flares up to not want to do it. As long as a person's volunteering to do something, they feel that, look, I'm choosing to do this. If I don't want to do it, I don't have to do it. But it's my choice to do it. I feel great about it. Therefore, I feel really good about myself. That's not as schar-worthy as a person who has the forced sense of, I got to get this done. I have to get this done. If I don't, I'm not going to be treated as neutral, but I have to do it. That internal dialogue, that internal struggle, Tosfos say, is the reason why a person gets more schar when a person is commanded. You know, people don't like being told what to do. Take my word for it. People don't like being told what to do, right? People have a hard time when they're commanded to do something. It's a lot easier to do something when it's our choice. You know, I remember when I was in high school, we had a chemistry teacher who was really, really grumpy. I guess we could say he had terrible chemistry with the kids, right? He was really, really bad, right? He had a really hard time getting along with people. And I remember, I was always really good. At least that's how I remember the story, right? And I remember one time leaving for the day and I said, you know, I'll call Mr. Wilson, you know, have a good night. And he said, don't tell me what to do. Now, I'm not sure if he was joking, but that really speaks to his personality that I couldn't tell if he was joking when he said, have a good night, don't tell me what to do. People don't like being told what to do, right? Right? So there are some times where a person may on their own want to do something, but as soon as they get told you have to do it, they don't want to. You know, I'm thinking of an anonymous husband, not myself, an anonymous husband who maybe is wearing certain clothes that they think, you know, this clothes is getting a little worn out. Maybe it's time to throw out this jacket. And the spouse comes along and she says, you know, throw out that jacket, it's terrible. I say, no, you know what? I like this jacket. You know, me and this jacket, after all we've been through together, I can't part with this jacket. Or think about a teen, you know, wakes up one day and says, you know, this place is a pigsty. You know, I'm living in this room, it's full of muck and all these terrible things. I'm going to clean up my room. And they get out of bed and they start picking up things. The parent comes in and says, look at this place. It's disgusting. How can you live here? Clean up your room. And the teen says, no. And they go back to bed. No one's going to tell me what to do. When it's your own idea, when it's something that you want to do, you're inspired to do so. When someone tells you you have to do it, it's what psychologists call reactance. Reactance. The 1960s psychologist gave this term. When a person feels that their free will is being challenged, when their free will is being challenged, they buckle down. No one tells me what to do. Even if on my own I could have gotten there, because I value this too. A clean room, a newer jacket. Even if I on my own could have gotten there, but no one tells me what to do. The mitzvahs get more schar because when HaKadosh Baruch Hu says you have to do it. If I wanted to do it, I'm volunteering, we say, great, easy peasy. You do it because you love it. When you have to do a mitzvah, there's a yetzahara, and it makes it harder. So you get more schar for doing it. Now, psychologists have done different studies about reactants. It's really shaped how advertisements work. People don't like being told what they have to do. You know, in the 1980s, the drinking age was changed from 18 to 21. And what studies showed was that in the years that followed that change, when the drinking age was raised, that those 19, 20 no longer were allowed legally to drink, the amount of people 18, 19, and 20 drinking doubled. People who had beforehand never thought of drinking and didn't care about drinking, but you're telling me I can't drink? It's illegal to drink? I'm going to go drink. People who didn't want to, but you're telling me I can't? No, I want to. And a lot of studies on advertisements have found that when ads say you must wear a seatbelt, you must quit smoking, you must quit drinking, they're less effective than when an advertisement simply points out, here are the merits for this side, here are the merits for that side, it's your choice. What Dessler would call challenging the rationalizations, but letting a person on their own come to it. Yeah, Neil.
I would go backwards.
Go ahead.
I completely understand why being told you must or you should not would evoke a reaction that was contrary to it. With the drinking, I think it's the other way. I think if it's illicit, there's more of a desire. That's more of a yetzahara. That's less of a, you're telling me I can't do it, so I'm going to do it anyway. No. Since you told me I can't have it, now I really want it.
Right. So the point was raised that it's not just that they're told they can't, but that it's made illegal, right? What Chazal would call Mayim Genuvim Yimtaku, right? Stolen waters are sweeter. I would argue that really it's the same principle at work. Something is illegal, there's this sense of it's not allowed, whether it's a person telling them or it's just now it's off limits. When something is off limits, then there's a sense of, oh, I can't have it? Now I really want it. I didn't want it before.
One's defiance, one's desire. I don't see them as the same.
Uh-huh. Okay. I hear what you're saying. You know, I know from my kids that I have twin four-year-old girls whose favorite toy is what the other one has, right? That's kind of your point. But like the desire for something that they can't have is an increased desire, right? I think to some degree, I would argue, and I hear your point that it's not exactly the same, but to some degree, I think it's because someone else has it. It means I don't have it. And if I don't have it, to some extent, I can't have it. And if I can't have it, I say, hey, why not me? You know, because as soon as the kid puts the toy down, they don't want it anymore. They only want it because someone else has it and because they can't have it. You know, and this is what we call like reverse psychology, right? Sometimes we trick kids into doing things, right? Sometimes my kids won't be eating dinner. I'll say, fine, I'm eating your dinner. No, I want to eat the Brussels sprouts. Where did that come from? You know, but as soon as you can't do it anymore, as soon as it's off the table, then it's like, whoa, I wanted to eat those Brussels sprouts. Why are you giving them away? Right? There's this sense of being contrarian, right? About wanting what a person is not allowed to have. And this really is the foundation for a tactic called motivational interviewing, which has really developed for substance use treatment to help get people into substance use treatment. I have mentioned the idea of motivational interviewing in the past, in passing, but I'd like to spend a couple of seconds really explaining what it is. Motivational interviewing really works with this principle that there's reactants. Again, reactants, R-E-A-C-T-A-N-C-E. Reactants is the sense of no one tells me what to do. All the time we try to get people to do things. We want kids to go to school. We want kids to stop using substances, not hanging out with these people. We want people to put on film. We want people to do stuff. What doesn't work is telling people they have to do it. You know, you have to make a change with yourself. You have to get a new job. You have to go out and lose weight. You have to. When you tell someone you have to do something, what springs to mind automatically are reasons not to. It's just natural. Reactant says, if I'm told I have to, I'm going to think of all the reasons not to. When a person is told you have to make a change, weight, health, religious observance, education, job, whatever, person is told you have to make a change, they will start to come up with reasons why they should not. And the more you push it, the more they resist. Like that, what do they call it, Chinese finger trap? The more you pull, the harder it is to get through. Because when a person feels forced and they feel that free will is being taken away, then they buckle down. Motivational interviewing was developed to get people into substance abuse treatment, where you don't go to a person and say, your life is a mess. You're ill. You're not well. You're going to kill yourself. You're draining all your money. You're not going to be a successful person. Don't you want better in life, huh? Just shape up. You got to get better. Doesn't work. People say, well, it's not so bad. I don't have to do it now. If you give people reasons to change, they're going to supply reasons not to change. Motivational interviewing kind of works together with someone, where it's not you against them, where it's you working with someone to say, I'm curious, what are your values? What do you want? Well, I'd like to be independent. Okay, so what's getting in the way of being independent? Well, I'm living at home and you won't give me the car and you won't give me all this stuff. Yeah, so I wonder why that's the case. Like, what do you think needs to happen? Well, I need to get a job. I need to get a job. So in order to get a job, what's getting in the way of the job? Well, I need to be able to, you know, be at work and be, you know, dressed up and be able to sit at a chair and do a task. Oh, so it sounds like there are certain things getting in your way. What do you want to do? That's very different than telling someone, your life stinks, everything has to turn upside down. And what was originally developed for substance use treatment, kind of tapping into a person's own motivations and to say, what's in it for you? And if they're at a point where they say, you know, I'm not bothered by this right now. I don't want to make a change. You might say, no, you need to make a change. Then they buckle down more and think of reasons not to change. You say, it's so frustrating. They don't want to change right now. How do I force them to change? Can't force someone to change. The more you take away their free will, the more they buckle down and say, no one tells me what to do. But there are ways to encourage it. Can you help a person reach rock bottom? And then rock bottom is a term that has gained notoriety in terms of substance use treatment. In Rav Dessler terms, it's that moment where they stop fooling themselves, but only because they came to it on their own. You know, after months and years of being told, you're going to throw your life away, you're throwing relationships away, you're never going to be able to get a job, after being told that for so many years to no avail, rock bottom means a person sits there, they look around and they say, I get it now. But only because I get it is it meaningful toward making a change. Because the person thinks it's up to me to make a change. And only when a person truly feels that they want to change, they're motivated to change, are they actually going to make a change. And in that scenario, we can use the motivational interviewing the opposite way. Give them reasons not to change. And let them supply the reasons to change. Now, I think this is too hard for you right now. I don't know if you're in a place right now to really take on a difficult task of sobriety. No, I think I'm ready. Yeah, you sure? It's going to be really challenging. You're going to have to suffer from withdrawal, and you're going to have to be away for a bit of time, and it's going to interfere with your ability of playing the cello. And they say, no, I really think I can give that up. You want the person themselves to come up with the reasons for change. If you tell them why they should change, they're going to think of all the reasons not to change. Help a person on their own see that they're not meeting their own goals. Help them state their goals. Help them explicate what it is that they want, and help them realize what's getting in the way. And as soon as they express a desire to change, push back. Tell them why they can't change. Tell them why it's too hard. Let them be the one to express the interest. Because if they don't, they're not going to get better anyway. They'll go to rehab, they'll be there for a couple of days, and they'll either cheat or they'll sneak out or something else. If they want to change, they can change. If they're being told to change, they will definitely not change. It's not only used for substance abuse, it's used for getting people into any kind of treatment, for any mood disorder or anything else. You tell someone you look awful, you need medication, you need help. You're creating in their minds reasons not to change. You want someone to start being more helpful around the house. You want someone to be able to be more available for the family. You want someone to be working more, whatever you want someone to change in. We're taking it out of substance abuse to any area of life. You can't change people, but you can help people come to what are your values, what's getting in the way, and what do you think will stop you from making this change. Let them be the ones to supply the reasons for changing. And in this sense, we kind of conclude our discussion on Kuntres HaBechira. Rav Dessler makes this point about what it is that's really the highest level, where he says that before he said the goal of life is to come to a point where everything is forced. You get the most schar when the person is following the mitzvos, and a person feels that I'm not really choosing not to speak Lashon Hara, it's obvious from Hashem. That raises the challenge of Hashem wants me not to speak Lashon Hara, but I do, and you're telling me not to, so I have this reactance, I have this visceral response. So I get extra schar because it's hard. But there's a higher level than that. What's the higher level? And we'll end off with this. Rav Dessler says, Amnam, third paragraph, Yesh madrega od gavoa mizo, where a person doesn't experience this reactance, where it's not Hashem wants this and I have to do it because it's so clear what's MS and what's Sheker, I feel like I have to, which ignites reactance, there's a better level. Hainu sheyakir kolkach shehara sheker hu ve'eno metzias klel. For a person to hit rock bottom and on their own truly feel that stealing Lashon Hara and Onas Devarim and Gezel and not davening and not keeping Shabbos, whatever we're talking about, whether it's religious, moral, ethical, in whatever area, for a person to come to a point, not just where it's a forced choice, because God said, no, it's a fire, it's poison, stay away. More than that, he comes to recognize the value of the good so much and the evil of the bad so much. Achelo yelo shum ratzon elav. You don't even desire the bad thing at all. You actually want it yourself. You don't feel forced, not because you have to do it, but because you want to do it. It matches your goals. And now all of a sudden, it's not just that you have to do it, but I want to do it. It's the most obvious thing in the world. The idea of being forced implies I'm resistant. I don't want to do it. There's this reactance there. This is a avodas Hashem me'ava. When a person say, a person who enjoys eating, what they say, I don't want to eat, but I have to eat because I have to survive. So I'm burdened with this forced choice. I have to eat, so I eat. A person lines up their desire to eat with the biological need to eat, and they stop viewing it as a need. They view it as a want. I said, this is wonderful. I want to eat. I want to enjoy myself. What if we can line up mitzvahs exactly the same way? What Chazal call, Asei Ritzono Ki Ritzoncha, in the second parak of Pirkei Avos. What if we turn Hashem's will into our will? Where we actually do the mitzvahs, not just because we have to, it's one madriga, where it's not a 50-50 choice, it's forced, it's gzeira, we have to do it, we get schar, great. What if we actually want to? I'm always struck by a Rebbe I had in fifth grade, who told us the story. He said, one time I was leaving the house to go to shul, and he said, I called up my family. I said, okay, I have to go to Maariv. I mean, I want to go to Maariv. Now, he's going to Maariv either way. And in some sense, he has to. Because he's already decided this is the right thing to do, and he's not really struggling with this. It's beyond his Bechira point. It's not something he's currently wrestling with. But the difference between have to go to Maariv and want to go to Maariv is huge. And this is a practical skill I'll leave you with that I use with all my therapy patients. All the time. All the time. When people deal with should, have to, must, there's a certain resistance and reactance that comes with that. I tell my clients, there is no such thing as have to. I say, give me an example. He said, I have to do my homework. I said, you don't have to do your homework. I said, I have to do my homework. I said, why? So, well, I have to pass the class. I said, you don't have to pass the class. I have to pass the class or else all the money is going to be wasted. I said, so all the money will be wasted. They said, but I don't want to pay that money back later. Oh, you don't want to. I have to get a job. You don't have to get a job. I have to get a job. Why? So I can get a better job. You don't have to get a better job. Why do I have to get a better job? Because I want to be able to get a house one day. Oh, you want to get a house? Oh, you want to get a house? People will say, I have to follow traffic laws. You don't have to follow traffic laws. But then I'll get a fine. So get a fine. I don't want to pay the fine. So don't pay the fine. I don't want to go to jail. Great. That's your choice. If you decided you wanted to go to jail tomorrow, you don't have to follow the traffic laws. No one's standing over you with tying your hands or forcing you to do anything. No one's forcing you to study for this test. Behind every have to is a want. Sometimes it's one step behind it. Sometimes it's 90 steps behind it. I have to redo this reading so I can pass this test, so I can get a good grade, so I can pass the semester, so I can get a degree, so I can get a job, so I can get a second job, so I can save up money, so I can get a house. The house is the want. Everything else is a precursor. So you could call this, I have to do this, but what if you change your language? What if you say, I want to do this assignment? You could want something and not enjoy it. There's no contradiction to say, I want something, and also I'm not enjoying it. But in some sense, you do want to do this assignment. No one's forcing you to be in school. My parents are going to be angry. So let your parents be angry. Well, I don't want to get in a fight. Okay, that's your choice. You don't want to get in a fight. You can get in a fight if you want to get in a fight. Every should can be re-verbalized as a want. And the difference on one's own psyche when they feel like they have to do something versus they want to do something is huge. Suddenly the assignment, which is unpleasant, it's my choice. I'm choosing to be in school. I'm choosing to stick it out. I'm choosing not to anger someone else. I'm choosing not to go to jail. I'm choosing not to have an exorbitant debt that I have to pay back for us. That's your choice. No one's forcing you to do anything. What if Avodas Hashem was like that? Yes, you have to. You have to. You don't have to. You don't have to. You have free will in the sense that you don't have to align your wants with Hashem's wants, and then you can face the consequences. That's your choice. Even if you feel like you have to, and you're going to do it anyway, but ultimately it's because I want to. I want to do Ratzon Hashem. I want to go to Olam Haba. Whatever the person's motivations are, Lishma, Lo Lishma, different levels. But the idea is that I want to. On some level, I want to. And each of us has the ability to change every should, every have to, every must. Try it. I've tried this out. It's life-changing. Change the way you think, change the way you feel, and change the way you look at life. Every should could be redefined as want, because behind every should is a want. It's your desire to want to follow this path down something that's enjoyable. So our takeaways for tonight. Number one, talked about actors on a stage, to explain how there's different starting points in a person's life. We just have to maximize our role, play the role, whether it's the Joker or it's the rich billionaire. We just have to play our role convincingly. And we're judged based not based on our temperament, but how we use the things we're given to play the role as a director typecast us. Number two, we talked about reactance. A person can get to a point where mitzvos feel that they're forced. And that's great to be in a place where it's no longer a choice to eat poison or speak lashon hara. But the danger that comes with that is this reactance. People don't like being told what to do. When working with other people, we can avoid igniting their reactance by asking what their values are. Let them come to it on their own, because the more you force it, the more they're not going to want to do it. Which is our final takeaway, that really for other people and ourselves, we have this ability every time we do a mitzvah, every time we do anything, to reframe it as something I want to do. Because if I want to do it, suddenly I'm aligning my retzon with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's retzon, and it's much easier for a person to do it. Ba'avo b'simcha.